that's where we are in the book. We're in their solution chapter. And then on Saturday, we finished the resentment inventory. I did four talks on that. We finished that yesterday, and they'll be on the site. Three of them are on the site. And so then we'll be studying on fear. Anybody have fear? So we're going to look at the fear instructions in the big book on Saturday. Anything else? I'm going to ask God to set aside everything I think I know about you, God, the steps, recovery, the big book, what's best for me, what's best for others. Especially let go of all my old ideas so I can live in your truth. Amen. And tonight, we're on Sunday night. We're towards the end of the study of the big book. We're on the family afterwards. And I was studying this today, and I'm going to try to cover four pages. There's a lot in here on the spiritual principles by which we live. To wives, we just finished that, and was it good? People thought it was really good. We got a lot of information. And family afterwards really is, the stuff we're going to read tonight is really how we should live. And we're going to start on page 124 tonight. And remember in the 12th step, it says, we're going to practice these principles in all our affairs. And so people said, well, where's those instructions in the big book? Well, they're in the chapter to wives, to employers, and family afterwards, a vision for you. They give us some examples of how we learn to live in the world with each other, especially with those people we're close to. So we're going to pick up with Henry Ford. Henry Ford started Ford Motor Company. He did the Model T, I think, in, 1908 or something. And it says, he once made a wise remark to the effect, page 124, that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. Anybody think that sounds good? I was thinking about it. We used to joke, because we were obnoxious, when we were interns and residents at the University of Chicago, because some of the attendings didn't seem real clinically sharp. And we used to say that they had 1 year's experience 30 times. Or you could have 30 years experience. Well, we were obnoxious. But the point is that you can have 1 year's experience and do it the same experience for 30 years, or you can gain experience. I think the same is true of recovery, right? It's a spiritual journey. And as you go through the journey, you get more experience, and then you can share that experience with other people. And remember, it's your experience. And it's the supreme value in life. And I think our spiritual experience is our supreme value in life. Does anybody agree with that? If we don't have a relationship with God, then we're missing out. And so that's what we seek, right? A spiritual experience, and then we relate that to other. And I also wrote that the big book is a book of experience, right? It's a testimony of what these people did and what their result was. And then they suggest that if you want what they experienced, you'll do what they did. Then I also thought about sponsorship. Sponsorship in the big book is really someone sharing their experience of working the steps with someone else. It wasn't a social thing. It was a spiritual path, walking hand in hand down spiritual path. And so experience is so necessary. And then the other thing I thought about experience is I experience fear. Anybody else do that? Well, if I have fear today, my experience has told me that I say the prayer to God, remove the fear, and direct my attention to how I should be. My experience is that it's not even true. My other experience is not even in the now. And it's just something I dreamed up to disturb me. So I say, good job, Michael. That's really stupid. And my experience is that I don't have to hang on to it today. And it's experience tells me that I'm playing God. And anybody get angry? Ever? So when I get angry, my experience tells me it's my fault. I'm disturbed. Something wrong with me. I'm judging again. I'm playing God. Stop it, Michael. It's stupid. And I ask God to remove my anger and direct my attention to to being love and tolerant. So my experience, the more I do my experience, the better it grows, the better I do things. And then 10 and 11 is really our experience each day, right? And then in the inventory at night is where we look at our experience, what we experienced during the day. And we take inventory. So experience is a powerful word. We don't talk about it enough in the in the meetings. Now there's bad experiences too. And we learn from them too, right? And they're going to talk about some of that tonight. It says, that is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. So the experience they're talking now is what brought us to our relationship with God. And isn't that what we're supposed to talk about when we share our story, right? When our experience, and are you willing to turn the past to good account? Now, are you willing to make the past into something good for you rather than dwelling on it? We grow, I look at the words, we grow by our willingness, again, the word willingness, to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. And so what are they talking about there? Well, our errors was our wrong thinking, right? And our character defects that are the result of being self-centered. And we also had errors in our behavior. Anybody hurt anybody? Anybody do bad actions? And so how do we rectify our bad actions? We take the amends, right? Steps 8 and 9. And how do we rectify errors in our thinking? And we have spiritual tools to do that. And then what we learn in the fourth step is basically our errors in our thinking in our whole life. And then we're going to convert that into assets. So we're going to learn that we don't have to be the person I created with my self-centeredness. I could be a different person. That's what the card's all about. I have some extra cards if people want them, but the left hand, the right hand side, I've learned that when I'm on the left hand side, I know what the experience is there. Nothing good. It's not good. And I don't have to live. I don't have to live on that experience, but this experience of living this way and recognize it tells me there's a different way. And so it's a powerful word. It says, the alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family and frequently the almost the only one. So they're talking about the family and relationships now, but it could be just you and other alcoholics, right? You and the world, you could share your experience. It's a principal asset, so it becomes an asset. And here's going to explain why. This painful past, anybody have a painful past? No? I was the only one? No painful past in here? You know, the thing is that it seems less painful the longer you're away, right? But when you think back, it was pretty painful. And I don't want to ever forget how bad it was towards the end. May be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. And why? Because we can show a way out, and we can show how we used our past to seek God and to have a spiritual change. We think each family which has been relieved, notice the word, and I wrote over family, you could put every alcoholic who has been relieved owes something to those who have not. Isn't that what we talk about it? We have to carry the message, we have to give it away. We have a tremendous responsibility. We have people dying left and right, and we have the ability to help them if they want it. We owe something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should only be too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. So you can use your past and your mistakes to help others, so that they don't have to commit the same mistakes. Or if they've made the same mistakes, you could tell them how you changed, which you did. And then it says, these next few lines, I starred this, it says, showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Isn't that what AA is about? It's showing others who suffer how we were given help. And isn't that what the big book is, really? It's just a textbook on people who suffered and the help they received and what happened to them. Remember, this is a book for people with a hopeless condition of mind and body. And there's nothing more satisfying than helping someone. especially another alcoholic. Cling to the thought. I love this. Cling to the thought. Cling to it. In God's hands, not my hands, but in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Now, Dr. Bob was a brilliant man, very religious, studied the Bible, went to the Oxford group, prayed all the time. But he was drunk every day. And he could not get sober. And he had actually given up. He had told the Oxford group members, they all knew it, but he told them that there's just no hope. There's no hope for himself. And remember, Henrietta Seibling prayed for him, and then 2 weeks later, Bill W. showed up in Akron, and he met Dr. Bob. Now, Bill W.'s dark past saved Dr. Bob, because Dr. Bob didn't understand the disease of alcoholism. He lived it, but he didn't understand. He didn't understand that he had absolutely no willpower to quit drinking, and he had no control of how much he could drink, and he thought he was just a sick sinner and undeserving of anything, and didn't see any way out. But once he understood that he had no power to change, then he could see and he could work the steps. He had to understand that he was powerless. It wasn't that he was a bad person, it was that he had no power. And so, and it's the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. So I think this paragraph can apply to other family members, to other human beings, and one alcoholic to another. The next paragraph, it's possible to dig up past misdeeds so they become a blight, a veritable plague. For example, we know situations which the alcoholic or his wife have had love affairs. In the first flush of spiritual experience, they forgave each other, drew closer together. The miracle of reconciliation was at hand. Then under one provocation or another, the aggrieved one would unearth the old affair and angrily cast its ashes about. Now, I think that line could be applied for things just besides love affairs. The aggrieved one will bring out all sorts of crap to make you feel like you, they have power over you. You see, and that's, you hear that a lot with new people. They have the wife or the ex-wife, and they have difficult situations. A few of us have had these growing pains, and they hurt a great deal. Now, here's a good sentence. Husband and wives have sometimes been obliged to separate for a time, and I love this, until new perspective, new victory over hurt pride can be re-won. Now, that's a great line. Because there's nothing worse than hurt pride for any of us. And that causes our resentments. And then if we don't have a way of getting over our hurt pride, then we can't have any kind of meaningful love and tolerance for the other person. And it's very hard to do, and I don't think I can do it without God. And so separating until people have gotten over their hurt pride so they can, what did we read last week? So we can meet on a common ground of love, tolerance, and understanding. And if you have hurt pride, you can't meet on that common ground. You can't have any kind of productive relationships. And isn't hurt pride really the cause of most of our resentments? And we learned how we get over resentments through these spiritual tools, through the prayers. And in most cases, the alcoholics survive this ordeal without relapse, but not always. So we think that unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences should not be discussed. So here they're telling us that the past is the key, and then here they're telling us the past occurrences should not be discussed. So what do they mean? Well, we're talking about the past that got us to surrender, to admit that we had hit bottom, that we were completely defeated, and that we were powerless so that we could turn away from ourselves towards God. And those events, but these past occurrences are the evil things we did where we hurt other people, they don't need to be discussed all the time. It says, we families of Alcoholics Anonymous keep few skeletons in the closet. I don't know if that's true today. The other thing is, when this book was written in 1939, let's say there were 10 members. Everybody knew the family. The wives went to the meetings. There were no secrets. When the guy relapsed, everybody knew what happened or what was going on. And there were small groups. There were 100 people. So they knew each other. They lived with around each other. It was a different world than it is today. Everyone knows about the other's alcoholic's troubles. This is a condition which in ordinary life would produce untold grief. There might be scandalous gossip. We don't scandalously gossip in AA, do we? I love that. So now when I call Stu, I'll say, "Dad, Stu, we're going to scandalously gossip for 5 minutes, and then we'll be done." You know, I love it. Scandalous gossip. Laughter at the expense of other people. You ever do that? It's sad. We all do that, but it's sad. A tendency to take advantage of intimate information. That's a horrible thing. Among us, these are rare occurrences. But it says, we do talk about each other a great deal, but we almost invariably temper such talk by a spirit of love and tolerance. So I wrote, do I practice this? Do you practice this? I mean, that's a powerful spiritual principle, that my talk should be a spirit of love and tolerance. So then what are my motives if I'm discussing someone? What are my real motives? And are they to make me look good and then look bad? Or am I trying to be love and tolerant and helpful? And that's a key thing for me to remember all the time. Another principle we observe, so these are principles what we've put, they're like 4, 5, or 6 so far. Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure he would approve. I think that's true. Some people worry about anonymity in like in AA, like somebody's in AA and they don't want to mention his name at another meeting. I don't know that that's the anonymity principle in the big book, but we don't have to relate. I saw a new guy, he was new then. This was several months ago, and I met with him before the meeting, and we talked, and I told him to come Sunday, and we would meet before the meeting, and this and that. So he went on Friday and saw a doctor and told his doctor all about me and AA and how helpful I was. And somebody I worked with, I don't know if they knew I was in the program or not, but I thought about it. I said, well, I don't know if that was really, you know, I didn't care. But I said to him, I said, you know, you're not really supposed to go around and tell everybody who's in AA and who isn't. But of course, he didn't show up ever again. So. But we find it better when possible to stick to our own stories. Isn't that true? A man may criticize or laugh at himself. It will affect others favorably. But criticism or ridicule coming from another often produces the contrary effect. So there are a lot of things to remember. Am I criticizing or ridiculing somebody? Or am I laughing at myself? There's a big difference. And members of a family should watch such matters carefully. And here's another one. One careless, inconsiderate remark has been known to raise the very devil. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just something that you may do it off the cuff and not even think about. But you don't know, see how it affects people. And it's another powerful. And here's a great line. I don't know if this is true for you, but it says, we alcoholics are sensitive people. I think they should have put very sensitive. And extremely sensitive, and in fact, we're beyond sensitive. I mean, we're looking for disfavor, look what he says. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. It's a very serious handicap to be sensitive, and I am sensitive because of my feeling of not being good enough, and wanting approval. And then when we're sensitive, what we do is we put other people as our higher power, because we're very sensitive to how we think they see us. And it's very important to us. And that, you know, when you live your whole life like that, it's very hard to change. I don't know if any of you have ever had that, but it's pretty common, and it's very common characteristic of alcoholics. So we're sensitive because we're insecure. And we're insecure with an egomaniac complex. Because our egos are so big that we're so insecure that we're not good enough. It's kind of crazy, but We could have a whole 8-hour discussion on that. And I wrote too sensitive because we are so needy. We're so needy. We're so needy of how other people see us and think of us. And now we don't have to worry about that. All we have to worry about is, are we serving God and others? Are we being love, patient, kind, and tolerant? It says many alcoholics are enthusiasts. What that means is we run to extremes. Anybody agree with that? At the beginning of recovery, a man may take, as a rule, one of two directions. I think this is really good information. He may either plunge, so that's like diving, into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he thinks, talks, or thinks of little else. In either case, certain family problems arise. With these, we've had experiences galore. And I want to tell you, the alcoholic who plunges into a frantic attempt to get his feet on business is actually moving far away from God. And then the people enthralled by their new life that they think or talk about, they've made recovery like a higher power. Not God, but the recovery itself, being a recovered. In either case, it's certain problems. Now, we think it dangerous if he rushes headlong at his economic problem. Now, would that be dangerous? Because you're putting money first above God. You're putting recognition above God. There's nothing wrong with trying to get your life better. But when it becomes your goal, then that becomes something that blocks you from God. Remember, whatever we worship. And I wrote, he wants to prove he is okay. And then what becomes important? Now remember, Bill W., his whole alcoholism started with the one line in the big book, right? The drive for success was on. He would prove himself somebody, right? He would show the world that he was going to be a great leader. And so that just fulfilled, was the way he was going to take care of his inferiority and his neediness. So it could become an obsession. And the family will be affected also pleasantly at first as they feel their money troubles are about to be solved. Then not so pleasantly as they find themselves neglected. So in other words, everything in moderation, everything in its place, right? Dad may be tired at night and preoccupied by day. He may take small interest in the children and may show irritation when reproved for his delinquencies. We don't like to be reproved for our delinquencies, do we? We get irritated. That means he got pissed off, right? Irritation for an alcoholic is like rage. And we don't want to have things pointed out. So if somebody says you're doing too much or you're not doing enough, then we get irritated, don't we? I saw physicians that worked all the time. I would get tired just looking at them. And they were obsessed with it. They were in there. There was one guy operated all night every night. I mean, what the hell is all about? And I just understood that he was never going to be happy. He said he loved his work, but I don't know if that's true. It became an obsession. And doctors are very guilty of that. I always tried to pace myself. And because when doctors would talk, they wouldn't say, how are the kids? They wouldn't say, take any vacations. When doctors would talk, they'd say, I'm busy. So if you weren't busy and you were a doctor, you were no good. Now, and this is the way the conversations would go, like in the 70s and 80s. Are you busy? Oh yeah, I'm really busy. That means you're okay. And it was a different way of looking at things. I don't know, I'm off the track here, but I don't know if that was helpful. But what are your priorities? If not irritable, he may seem dull and boring, not gay and affectionate as the family would like him to be. Now here's the other problem is the family has expectations of dad. So there, and it says they get disappointed. Mother may complain of inattention. They're disappointed. Why are they disappointed? They have an expectation of how things should be. And so you'll see that in relationships. It could be in the work. It could be in your job. And often let them feel it. Beginning with such complaints, I love this, a barrier arises. There's a barrier. What is the barrier between who? Well, you and the other person, because they have expectations and you have your expectations and there's conflict, right? He is straining every nerve to make up for lost time. He is striving to recover fortune and reputation and feels he is doing very well. And so he wants to recover his fortune and reputation. His drive for success is on. Sometimes mother and children don't think so. They don't think he's doing well. Have he been neglected and misused in the past? And look at the words he uses. They think. So they've decided father owes them more than they are getting, right? So they're making a playing God on dad. And they're saying how dad should be. They wanted him to make a fuss over them. Look at the next word. They expect him to give them the nice times they used to have. So they're thinking what's owed, expected. It all triggers resentment, right? But dad doesn't give freely of himself. And then he uses the word, resentment grows. He becomes still less communicative, so they go in their corners, right? And sometimes he explodes over a trifle. The family is mischievous. And then look what they do. They criticize, pointing out how he's falling down in his spiritual program. Now, that is not a good environment to live in. That's not a good way of living. But you see how the alcoholism put people in a position in the relationships where they each one has their own viewpoint of how things should be. And he's going to talk about that in the next few paragraphs. This sort of thing can be avoided. He writes, both father and the family are mistaken. They're both wrong, right? They're seeing things wrong, though each side may have some justification. Remember we talked about justified anger? It doesn't exist for alcoholics. It is of little use to argue and only makes the impasse worse. Now here's some really good, in the next few paragraphs, some really good examples of how we should live. The family must realize that dad, though marvelously improved, is still convalescing. He's not a spiritual giant. We're recovering. We're learning to grow and live without alcohol, right? We're learning how to live sober. We don't become emotional sober giants after 30 days, right? And it's a process, right? They should be thankful he is sober, and the alcoholic should be thankful they're sober. We get down on ourselves, like if we act out or we say the wrong thing early in recovery, we beat ourselves up. We may have thankful that we're sober and able to be of this world once more. Remember, it says it's progress, not perfection, remember? And we're going to make mistakes. It says, let them praise his progress. Isn't praise helpful? Kindness, saying a kind word instead of criticizing. Let them remember that his drinking wrought all kinds of damage that may take long to repair. And the alcoholics have to remember that. When you're living with people, you're in relationships. If they sense these things, they will not take so seriously his periods of crankiness. Well, this doesn't apply to any of us. We'll skip this line. Periods of crankiness, depression, or apathy, which will disappear when there is tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding. Now, this line can be used in your whole life, the rest of your life. If there's tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding towards someone, then they're going to react differently. I talk about that all the time. How we be is what we bring into a situation, how we be, we get out of it. Isn't that what the St. Francis prayer is? You know, if you're bringing love where there's hatred, you're bringing forgiveness where there's wrong, harmony where there's discord, truth where there's error. You know, the whole St. Francis prayer. And so if there's tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding, then people won't have their corners. They won't have their positions. And then the head of the, and these, I don't know about you, but there are a lot of advice here on how to live my life. The head of the house ought to remember that he is mainly to blame for what befell his home. Remember, we talked about the fourth column of resentment. Where were we to blame? He can scarcely square the account in his lifetime, but he must see the danger of over-concentration on financial success. Although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, and look at this, we found that we could not place money first. For us, and I love this line, material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never precedes it. And making a lot of money won't make me spiritually fit. And it won't really even make me happy. Happiness comes from inside, from my relationship with God, how I am being towards other people. Money won't change that. material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never preceded. You've heard a lot of people say, well, I can't work the steps yet. I gotta get a job, and you know, I've got to get, you know, money, and I got to get a new car, and then I'll work the steps. Since the home has suffered more than anything else, it is well that a man exert himself there. He is not likely to get far in any direction if he fails to show unselfishness and love under his own roof. See, we can't change other people, but we could try to practice the spiritual principles of love and tolerance, unselfishness, be patient, understanding, not criticize, right? Meeting on common ground, not making comments that irritate or criticizing. And we know there are difficult wives and families, so the man is getting over alcoholism must remember he did much to make them so. And isn't that true, right? People have reacted thus. As each member, look what he calls it, a resentful family, begins to see his shortcomings and admits them to others, he lays a basis for helpful discussion. Now remember on 83, I read this line that I don't think too many people do. And then I'm going to end with this. Before I get that, the family talks will be constructive on page 127 if they can be carried on without heated argument, self-pity, self-justification, or resentful criticism. You can't have a constructive talks with another human being if there's self-pity, self-justification, or resentful criticism in any human being. You can't have any constructive. So if you're bringing that in, you're not going to get anything that's good out of it. On page 83, they talk about there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. They're in the ninth step now. We must take the lead, a remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it. I don't know if that's done anymore. Being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So here's the line. So we clean house with the family. And here's, I do this every morning. I say in meditation, my Creator showed me the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And I guarantee if you show that and practice it, we don't do it, some of the times we don't do it well at all. But if you do that, things are going to get better. And I'm going to close with that. I'm just going to say in that chapter that everybody likes on from Dr. Paul on Acceptance is the Answer. And he talks about how he would see everything that was wrong with his wife, right? He would constantly criticize her. And once he stopped criticizing her and he saw her good points, she reacted better to him. And I know that's true. It's true in my house. So anyway, we'll end with that. We have some time to open up. I think this chapter had a lot of good stuff in it, didn't it? Mm-hmm.